We're on Mem Chesem and Aleph, seven lines down, the last word on the line where it says, Tanya. Our mission discussed a case where a customer made a purchase. He had received produce from some chedvani, a storekeeper, and a dispute arose as to whether he made the payment. First opinion in the Mishnah ruled that the customer must take a shvua, swear to his claim that he paid already. However, Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah said it's not necessary for the customer to swear. And he simply wins the case based on a presumption that a seller will not deliver his produce until he is first paid, unless we know that this seller typically extends credit, makes such arrangements. But in general, the expectation is that first he gets paid and then he'll give the produce. Therefore, the customer is believed that he paid already. The Gemara presents a brice in which Yehuda's view is presented more clearly. Again, the first opinion had said that the customer will need to take an oath that it's true that he paid already. Tanya, it says in the Braisa, Rabbi Yehuda said, in response to this position, Amasai, when would I agree that the customer would have to swear in order for us to accept his claim? Bizmansha peros tzvruin munachin. That would be the halacha only if the produce was sitting there, piled up, not yet delivered to the customer. Shnei and Orun Alein, and a dispute arose between these two litigants whether the customer paid. So Rabbi Yehuda says, in that situation, I would agree that it would be necessary for the customer to swear that he paid already. Avol hefshilan bekupaso la'acharav. But says Rabbi Yehuda, if the customer already is in possession of the produce, it's in his little bag that he threw over his shoulder, and then the dispute arose as to whether he paid. In that situation, says Rabbi Yehuda, we would go by the general principle of Hamotzi Mechaver Valavaraya. We say whichever disputant is trying to take money from the other disputant has the burden of proof. That is, the Rabbanan did not require an oath in this situation, since there is a specific presumption in the defendant's favor here, which is that usually the produce won't be delivered until the customer first pays. The first opinion, on the other hand, is of the opinion that, no, even in this situation, the customer has to swear. The Rabbanan enacted that he must take an oath, even though he is the mochzik, he's the one in possession of his money. The other one's trying to collect from him, but the Rabbanan recognized that often with these kind of transactions, things can get confused, and therefore they imposed an oath obligation on the defendant. The Mishnah then presented another case in which the first opinion of Yehuda disagree, this time involving a money changer. Somebody approaches this shulchani, this money changer, seeking to exchange his dinar for smaller coins. And again, dispute arises. The customer claims he already gave the dinar for the smaller coins. Shulchani says, no, I did not receive the dinar from you yet. So once again, the Mishnah presents a dispute between Tanakama and Rabbi Yehuda. Tanakama says that the Rabbanan imposed an oath on the defendant. He must swear that he paid that dinar already into the Shulchani. But Rabbi Yehuda said, no, the halacha is completely in favor of the defendant. We assume that it's true that he paid, and therefore he is exempt from payment even without any oath. The question is why the Mishnah needed this second case. It seems to be the same dispute, just applied to a different context. So what new point do we learn from this case? So the Gemara explains, Zutricha. In fact, it was necessary for the Tana of our Mishnah to teach us both of these cases. For Iyash Mu'inan, HaKamaisa, had the Mishnah only taught us the first case of the person purchasing the produce, I might have said, B'hach ka'amri Rabbanan, that in this case, the Rabbanan argue that it's plausible that the storekeeper gave the produce right away, even before receiving payment, mishum d'peiri avidi d'mirkavi, because produce, of course, pretty quickly can spoil, can go bad, even the mirkavi lo mashu lehu. Storekeeper, therefore, will not delay in quickly getting his product off his hands into the customer's possession. He's thinking, I don't want it to go bad before the customer receives it, then he'll decide not to buy it. And so it's perfectly conceivable that the chenvani would deliver this produce before being paid. Hence, we have the customer swear that he already paid. Aval mo'os de'lo merkevi e'ma mo'de lehu l'Rabbi Yehuda. Whereas in this second case, it involves currency, which of course is not going bad anytime soon. I might have said that the Rabbanan in this case agree with Rabbi Yehuda, that there's a presumption in the customer's favor that Shochani wouldn't give his product, in this case the smaller coins, until he's first paid. And so we should simply believe the customer that he paid already and not require him to swear. The Mishnah teaches us that, in fact, the Rabbanan do require an oath even in this second case of the money changer. And the Gemara now explains, V'i itmar beha, and now we can also understand why if the Mishnah only taught the second case of the money changer, well then I might have said, beha ka'amar Rabbi Yehuda. It's specifically in this case that Rabbi Yehuda exempts the customer from swearing that he paid already, because there's no reason to think the money changer would give his product to the customer before receiving the payment, the dinar. But if you're talking about produce which can quickly go bad, I might have said that Rabbi Yehuda agrees to the position of the Rabbanan that there is a rabbinic oath required of the customer due to the very real possibility that the storekeeper gave that produce right away, even before receiving the payment. And so the Mishnah teaches us that it's not true. That in fact, even in this case, Rabbi Yehuda exempts the customer. He continues to assume that the seller would not deliver the goods until he first received the payment. So we see that tzricha, we see why, in fact, both cases here were needed. The Mishnah then taught that there is a rabbinic oath by orphans who are attempting to collect a debt that was owed to their father. The Gemara asks, Miman? Who exactly are these orphans collecting from? Ilema milova. If they're collecting from the borrower himself, why would the Rabbanan say that they have to swear first before collecting, that the debt wasn't collected already? Why should that be? Avuon shalka belo shvua v'inu b'shvua. If their father was collecting the debt, you know, producing this loan document, he surely would have simply collected without having to swear first. There's no such halacha if you have a loan document and you're collecting from the borrower. Assuming the document has been verified, the lender simply collects, doesn't have to swear. And yet if the orphans are collecting with this loan document, they have to swear. Why should they have to swear? Gemara therefore explains that hachi kama, this is what the Mishnah means to say. V'chein hayisomim min hayisomim lo yiparu ela b'shvua. The Mishnah is saying that if orphans are collecting from orphans, that is, the borrower is no longer alive. So now the orphans of the lender are collecting from the orphans of the borrower. Says the Mishnah, they may only do so if they first swear that to the best of their knowledge, the debt wasn't already paid. The Gemara now presents a significant qualification of this halacha, and that is Rav Shmuel, the Amri Tarvayu. Rav and Shmuel both said the following. Lo shanu ela shemeis malva mechayilova. The Mishnah's ruling that the lender's orphans may swear that, to the best of their knowledge, the debt was not collected, and then after taking that oath, they may collect from the borrower's orphans. That's only if the lender died before the borrower. For in this situation, the lender himself never became obligated to take any oath if he would want to collect, since the borrower did not die in his lifetime. He, the lender, died, and so when later the borrower dies, and now we have this rabbinic oath that becomes incumbent on the lender's orphans to swear that to the best of their knowledge, the debt was not collected already. Rabbi Shmuel said, Avo meis lova b'chaye malva. If the borrower had died before the lender, well, in that situation, kfar nischayev malva libinei lova shvua. The lender himself already incurred an obligation to swear. You know, if he would want to collect from the borrower's orphans, he himself would have to swear. Rabbanan, you know, enacted, if you want to collect from the orphans, you have to first swear that the debt wasn't paid. Now, the specific oath that the father would have to take is an unequivocal oath stating that, you know, I know for a fact that I didn't collect this debt already. This lender then died before having taken any oath to collect. And now there's a problem for the lender's orphans. For ve'ena de morish vua lebanov. The father cannot transfer through inheritance the right to collect a debt when there is an oath obligation attached to that debt. For the orphans are unable to take the specific oath that the estate incurred, namely to swear, I know for a fact, I'm 100% certain that the debt wasn't paid. The orphans are not able to take such an oath. They aren't the actual lenders. Being that they're unable to take the oath that this estate incurred for being able to collect the debt, they simply cannot collect this debt. So said Rav and Shmuel. The Gemara relates that the ruling of Rav and Shmuel was controversial. Shalchua kamei de Rabbi Elazar, for they sent this ruling to Rabbi Elazar along with the question of Shavua zu mativa. What is the nature of this oath obligation that apparently is so significant that Rav and Shmuel say that because the lender's orphans can't swear the exact same oath that the father would have had to take, and therefore they lose their ability to collect the debt. Do you agree with this ruling? Shalach lehu. Elazar sent back that he disagrees. And rather, the halacha is even if the borrower had died before the lender, halacha is yarshin ishbayin shvus yarshin v'notlin. It's not a problem for the lender's orphans. They swear to the best of their ability. They take the shvuas yarshin, the oath of the inheritors, in which essentially they swear that to the best of their knowledge, the debt wasn't already paid, and then they can go ahead and collect the debt. And that's good enough, Rabbi Elazar says. The Gemara brings other Amoraim on this issue. Shalchua b'mei Rabbi Ami. They sent this question there to Yisrael in the days of Rabbi Ami and Omar. And he was like exacerbated with this. And he exclaimed, Kulei hai shalchu lo ve'ozli. Keep on sending this question. Yeshkechinen botayma milo shalchinen lehu. If I had an answer, if I had something to say, would I not have already sent an answer? But then Rabbi Ami proceeded to say something about the matter. Elam Rabbi Ami. Rabbi Ami said this about this question. Hoel v'yasoliyada neima b'milsa. Okay, once Chevra is bringing up this topic, we'll say something about it. And that is, I say the following. That really this controversial ruling of Rav and Shmuel is more limited than we thought. For actually, it only applies in the following case. If Amad Bidin Umeis, Rav and Shmuel are merely saying that if the borrower died and the lender actually brought his loan document to court to collect, thus like really incurring an oath obligation, and then Umeis, he died before he had a chance to actually swear and collect. Rabbi Ami says, in this situation, Rav and Shmuel say, that we say, Kfar nischayv malva l'bnei lo v'shvua, v'yena demar shvua l'banav. They make their argument that, look, the estate already incurred this specific oath obligation to swear definitively that the debt wasn't paid already, and therefore, this debt cannot be transferred to the yarshim, because they, of course, are unable to make such an oath. However, says Rabbi Ami, if lo amad bidin umeis, if the lender himself had not actually went to court and litigated to collect his debt, even if the borrower died before him, and then this lender died, it would not be a problem. Rather, we would say, Yarshin Ishbayin Shfuas Yarshin V'notlin. The lender's orphans would simply swear that to the best of their knowledge, the debt wasn't already collected. And then they would collect the debt, no problem. Rabbi Ami argues that if the lender didn't actually take the case to court, then the estate did not actually incur the oath obligation, and so you avoid this problem of the orphans being unable to fulfill the specific oath obligation that the estate incurred, and therefore, here it wouldn't be an issue. The lender's orphans could just, again, swear the Shvus Yarshin that, to the best of their knowledge, the debt wasn't collected, and then they can go ahead and collect. Well, the Gemara objects to Rabbi Ami's distinction. Maskif lor of Nachman. When Nachman questioned this, he said, Atu beidina kemechayvi leishvua. Is it the court really that creates the oath obligation? Says Rav Nachman, that's not the way it works. Rather, meidna de shachiv lova, echayv leimalva lebinei lova shvua. The moment the borrower dies, the lender incurs a rabbinic obligation to swear before he could collect. Says Rav Nachman, it's not dependent on actually taking the borrower to court and demanding the payment. Rather, the oath is incurred automatically upon the death of the borrower. And so, Elam Rav Nachman, rather Rav Nachman said that he issa l'derav u'shmuel, issa. If we accept the teaching of Rav and Shmuel, then indeed if the borrower predeceased the lender, and then the lender died, the lender's orphan simply would not be able to collect, because they can't take that same oath that their father had incurred upon the death of the borrower. Elasa, elasa. If we don't accept the teaching of Rav and Shmuel, then fine. Then this whole issue would not be an issue. Rather, we would say the lender's orphans swear that to the best of their knowledge, the debt wasn't paid, and that would be acceptable. Even though, technically, their father incurred a different type of oath, a more forceful oath. The Gemara remarks, Alma Misafkale, from Rav Nachman's language, it's clear that there were two possibilities in his mind. Maybe we don't accept the opinion of Rav and Shmuel, maybe we do. The Gemara says this appears to be a contradiction. For Veha Amar Rav Yosef Bar Min Yumi, as we learned about yesterday, Rav Yosef Bar Min Yumi said, Oved Rav Nachman Uvda Yachloku. In an actual case in which neither litigant was able to swear about the issue at hand, neither was qualified to swear, Nachman ruled that they split the money as per the opinion of Rabbi Yossi. If Rav Nachman concurred with Rabbi Yossi, the whole discussion of whether we accept the teaching of Rav Shmuel or not doesn't begin. Because Rav and Shmuel are working on the premise that when you have this kind of situation where neither litigant could swear the proper oath that needs to be taken, the halacha is the defendant does not have to pay, as Rabbi Meir in the Mishnah ruled. And so Rav Nachman's implication that maybe the halachas like Rav and Shmuel seems incompatible with this practical ruling that Rav Nachman issued in accordance with Rabbi Yossi, that being unable to swear doesn't mean the person loses the money completely. It means we split the money. So it seems like a contradiction. The Gemara answers that Rav Nachman's statement here, where he states that maybe we go with the interpretation of Rav and Shmuel, that statement was saying, L'dvarav de Rabbi Meir ka'amar, v'lei lo svirale. It's an academic discussion here of how to interpret the Tana Rabbi Meir, who says, according to Rav and Shmuel's understanding, that if neither litigant can swear, then the defendant is simply exempt. In that world of Rabbi Meir, Rav Nachman says it's possible that the halacha is like Rav and Shmuel, that we take this hard line, that if an oath was incurred already by the estate, and the orphans can't make that same oath, well then they cannot collect. That's all Rav Nachman was saying, but Rav Nachman's own personal view, which is that we rule like Rabbi Yossi, we certainly would not completely exempt the defendant, even if these orphans can't take the proper oath, the halacha would still be that we split the money. Mark continues with a question on the opinion of Rav and Shmuel. And this question is from a Mishnah in Ksubas. The Mishnah there mentions that we know, of course, that upon her husband's death, the widow then has the right to collect her Ksuba. The Mishnah there teaches that if the widow moves into the home of the orphans, who support her, they take care of her after their father's death, the widow has a window of 25 years to collect her Ksuba. After that time, the presumption is that she has waived her right to collect the Ksuba. So now let's recognize that a woman with a Ksuba in her hand, with the right to collect her Ksuba, is a creditor. And the people of her deceased husband's estate are the debtors. And of course, if she would exercise her right to collect her Ksuba, she would first have to swear that it wasn't paid already before she collects from the orphans. And the Mishnah there rules as follows. Mesa, what if the widow died within 25 years? She still had not collected her ksuba, says the Mishnah, Yor Sheha Maskirin es ksubasa ad esrim b'chameh shanim. Her inheritors, her orphans, will have the ability to collect the ksuba within that same time frame. They would have to put in a claim for the ksuba within that 25 years from the husband's death. The Mishnah is clearly saying that if they demand that ksuba within 25 years, they will be able to collect. So this appears to refute Rav and Shmuel. As we're talking about a case where the creditor, in this case, the woman who was owed a ksuba, incurred an obligation to swear. She would want to collect, she would have to swear that the ksuba wasn't paid already. She dies, the Mishnah is saying that her inheritors could collect, even though her inheritors are unable to swear what she would have been able to swear, definitively that for sure the ksuba was not collected already. Rather, they would have to swear that to the best of our knowledge, the ksuba wasn't collected already, and yet, apparently that's good enough, which appears to be against Rav and Shmuel. The Gemara deflects the proof by saying, Hachav amaya skinan, here in this Mishnah, what are we dealing with? Why her heirs could collect that ksuba? The case is that the widow in question had actually taken the oath. She had sworn already that the ksuba wasn't collected, so that obligation was already fulfilled. She just didn't actually collect yet. So in this case, certainly, her heirs can go ahead and collect that ksuba. So this is not a proof against Rav and Shmuel at all. The Gemara attempts another disproof, Tashma. Come and hear a different Mishnah there in Ksubas, which relates the law, the enactment of Ksubas benin dichrin, the ksuba of the male children. And it means the following. This enactment addresses a scenario where a person gets married and has children, his wife dies, and then he gets remarried, has more children, and this time he dies before his second wife. Without any special enactment, the only ksuba payment would be to the second wife and her heirs. First wife's family, though, wouldn't receive any ksuba payment because she died before her husband. The Rabbanan realized that this could be a problem because a father, when considering how much of a dowry to give to his daughter, might want to hold back on the amount, knowing that if his daughter dies before her husband, then the money he's giving her will simply be inherited by his son-in-law's family. And if there's children with a future wife, they'll end up with that money. So the Rabbanan said that if that eventually happens, there's children from his second wife, they will not have the right to inherit the ksuba portion of the first wife. Rather, the male children from the first marriage will have exclusive rights to the ksuba amount when dividing up the inheritance. The question that this Mishnah deals with is, what if there's only enough in the estate for one or the other? It is, the estate only has enough to pay either the conventional ksuba debt that is owed to the second wife or her heirs, or we can pay this amount for the enactment we just mentioned, the ksubas benindichrin, the ksuba amount that is owed to the family of the first wife. So Toshma, come in here what the Mishnah says there about this. But again, we have this situation where Nasa Rishona Umesa, man got married, had children, then his wife died. Then Nasa Shnia, he married a second wife, and children, Umes, who? He died before her. And now it's time to divide up the inheritance, but there's only enough to pay one of the creditor parties. Says the Mishnah, the halacha is Shnia V'Yarsheha, Kodamin L'Yarsheha Rishona. The family of the second wife. So either it could be she herself, or if she died, and this is an important part, if she died and her heirs are now, you know, collecting for this debt, the ksuba debt, to this second wife, they would be given priority, they have precedence before the sons from the first wife. And the reason is because the nature of the obligation to the second wife's family is it's a debt. We have a creditor here who is owed a ksuba. So it's, you know, a regular kind of debt being collected, as opposed to the rabbinic enactment we mentioned of the ksubas benin dichrin was enacted in the form of inheritance. It's technically considered inheritance. Now, the halacha is that if there's only enough to pay either a creditor or an inheritor, the creditor comes first. Hence, the family of the second wife who are coming to collect the conventional ksuba would come first. The Gemara's point here is very similar to the last proof, which is we have a situation where the debtor, the husband, died before the creditor in question, i.e., the second wife, which means that upon the death of the husband, the second wife incurred an obligation to swear that the ksuba wasn't collected already before she'd be able to collect now. And yet, the Mishnah is apparently saying that even after her death, her inheritors could collect too, even though they can't swear that, you know, we know 100% that the ksuba wasn't collected. They just swear to the best of our knowledge it wasn't collected. Mishnah apparently is saying that that's just fine, which is against the opinion of Rav and Shmuel. But again, the Gemara answers, we could say Hachanami here as well. The case is, we'll limit the Mishnah's ruling to a situation where Shenishba Meitza, where it so happens that the second wife already took the oath, she already swore that she wasn't given the ksuba already, and that's why, of course, if that's the case, her orphans could go ahead and collect. The Gemara now brings another proof against Rav and Shmuel, and this time we can't answer like we did above. And this proof is also from a Mishnah on Ksubis. The Mishnah there is discussing a case where a husband specifically stipulated at the time of his marriage, he said that when you eventually come to collect your ksuba, assuming, of course, that you do not predecease me, the husband said, I waive the right to demand that you take an oath, whether it's you collecting or if in the end it's your inheritors who are collecting the ksuba, they need not first swear that the ksuba wasn't paid already. The Mishnah there says such a stipulation is binding, and therefore if she or her inheritors come to collect the ksuba, they need not swear. The Mishnah then continues with this, Avol Yorshav Mashbien Osav Yes Yorshav Yes Abayin Birushusa. If, however, she or her inheritors are collecting the ksuba because he died, as opposed to, you know, her collecting the ksuba if they got divorced, if it's a case where she became a widow, and so that means that now she or her yarshim are collecting from his orphans, says the Mishnah, his stipulation doesn't apply to that situation, and therefore his orphans can force her or her orphans to swear before collecting the ksuba from the estate. So again, we're talking about a situation where the debtor, the husband, died before the creditor, his widow. And yet the Mishnah is clearly saying that her orphans may collect, just that his orphans can demand them to swear first. Now, obviously you can't answer here that, oh, she already took the oath. It's saying that, no, his orphans can force her orphans to take the oath now. So this seems to be a refutation of Rav and Shmuel. It seems to be saying that even though these orphans cannot swear exactly as Zershi would be able to swear, they can't swear, you know, definitively, they'll have to say it to the best of our knowledge, and yet that's acceptable, so it seems against Rav and Shmuel. Gemara answers, Amar Rav Shemaya says, Litzstadin Ketani. Rav and Shmuel, we have to say that, like, you know, break the Mishnah into two different parts, there's two different sides here. That is, that when the Mishnah mentions Osa, that, you know, if it's his orphans, if he died, they can force an oath. In the case where it's so she herself, the widow herself, collecting, Bilamana, indeed, that is a situation where she's a widow, where he, the husband, died. But Vyarsha, when the Mishnah mentions that her orphans can be forced to swear, that only applies Begrusha. In a case where the Ksuba obligation was activated based on the fact that she became a divorcee. If a woman gets divorced, then she could simply collect her ksuba from her husband without taking an oath. And therefore, if she dies and her heirs are collecting, they too can collect without an oath. If the husband that subsequently died, in that case, her orphans can collect from his orphans by taking the Shavuos Yarshin. That is, they swear that to the best of their knowledge, the ksuba wasn't collected already. And that, of course, is fine, even according to Rav and Shmuel, because it's not a case where the original creditor incurred a different oath. So according to this reading, this Mishnah is not a problem either for Rav and Shmuel. Gemara questions the opinion of Rav and Shmuel again from a Braisa. Masiv Rav Nosson Bar Oshaya. Rav Nosson Bar Oshaya asked and Rav and Shmuel from this Braisa. The Braisa says, Yafa koach ha-ben mi koach ha-af. A son has greater legal latitude to collect a debt that was incurred to his father than the father himself. Continuing to Amud Bey's how so? Raisa says, Sha'ben gova ben mishvua ben shalo mishvua. For whereas the son can collect the debt that was incurred to his father even without taking an oath, ve'avin a gova le mishvua. Whereas the father himself, the creditor himself, was only able to collect if he took an oath. So says the Braisa, of course, it's a bit vague, you know, what exactly it's referring to. So the Gemara explains further, Hechi Dami, what case is the Braisa referring to? Apparently refers to our situation, where Demes Lova V'chaye Malva, the borrower died before the lender. Because if we're talking about where the debtor, the borrower, is still alive, then the Braisa's statement is clearly not true, because in that situation, the father doesn't have to take an oath either. So obviously it's talking about where the borrower died. Consequently, if the lender would want to collect from the borrower's orphans, he would first have to swear. Uketani in the Braisa teaches, it contrasts the son to the father by pointing out, Sha'ben gova ben bishvu o ben shalo bishvu. Sometimes the son might have to swear, but sometimes he would not have to swear. Meaning, bishvua, the son might possibly have to swear. What would he swear? Shvus Yarshin. The oath of the inheritors, he swears that to the best of his knowledge, he has no indication, his father didn't tell him, there's no other indication that the debt was already paid. The orphans can take that oath and collect. The Braisa is pointing out that Shalom B'Shvua, it's also possible for the lender's orphans to collect even without any oath at all. That is, Karaban Shimon Ben Gamliel. The Braisa is alluding to the opinion in our Mishnah we learned of Rabban Shimon Ben Gamliel, who said that if the father said at the time of his death, he made it known, he said very clearly, the debt was not paid yet, then Rabban Shimon Ben Gamliel said the orphans don't have to swear at all before collecting. The point for us is this. The Braisa, according to this reading, is saying that even though the borrower died before the lender, which means that the lender incurred an oath to swear, you know, 100% that the debt was not paid, and yet if the lender dies, his orphans can make this lower level oath, the Shvuas Yarshin, to swear that to the best of their knowledge it wasn't paid yet, and then they could collect, which is not like Rav and Shmuel said. The Gemara answers, I'm Rav Yosef, Ho'amani, who is the Tana behind this Braisa? Beis Shamayhi. The Braisa follows the view of Beis Shamay, the Omri, Shtaro, Mei Ligvos, Kigovoidami. Says that whenever you have a creditor who has a document in his hand stating that somebody owes him money, the money of the debt is legally considered to be in the possession of the creditor. It's as if it was collected already. That is, when deciding, you know, who is in possession here to determine, you know, who has the burden of proof, we consider the money to be in the possession of the creditor, the person holding the document, which of course would, you know, serve to his advantage. Let's apply this principle to our case. Gemara is saying, really, Rav and Shmuel are right. if the appropriate specific oath that was originally incumbent on the plaintiff cannot be taken, then we leave things as they are. And the person claiming the money does not get the money. But who is really claiming the money? You would say the creditor is claiming the money. According to Beis Shammai, not true. It's the other way around. It is the debtor who hopes to be able to repossess this money, not in the physical sense, of course. He has the money in his bank, but legally, the money is in the possession of the creditor. So if we have this technicality that the proper oath cannot be taken, then we simply leave things as they are. The result, according to Beis Shammai, is that the lender's orphans win the case. They get the money. Because again, legally, they already are considered to be in possession of the money. So we say to the borrower's orphans, I'm sorry, even though the lender's orphans didn't take the full, adequate oath they're supposed to, you unfortunately still lose the case because these other orphans are actually considered the ones to be in possession of the money. So according to this, the b'raisa is not a problem for Rav and Shmuel at all. Gemara continues and relates that Ikla Rav Nachman Lesura. Nachman came to Sura, and the Ula Gaber of Chista Varaba Varafuna Rulei, Chista Varafuna, came to greet Rav Nachman who traveled there into Sura, and they asked Rav Nachman about our topic, Lesi Mar Nakra Lahad Ravu Shmuel. They proposed to Rav Nachman, come, let's uproot this teaching of Rav and Shmuel. They assumed they would get Rav Nachman's assistance because we concluded above that Rav Nachman does not agree with Rav and Shmuel. Rav Nachman responded, Amr Lahu Kafaliva Sai Kolani Parsi Lamakra Lahad Ravu Shmuel. You think I traveled all this way, this many parsos, come and uproot the teaching of Rav and Shmuel? I refuse to do so. Nachman was saying that since Rav and Shmuel said this, we have to abide by it. It automatically has authority, even if I personally disagree, we cannot come out and pronounce against Rav and Shmuel. However, Rav Nachman did say, Alahavu delolosif Allah. I do direct you, however, to limit Rav and Shmuel's ruling as much as possible, only to the specific context in which they said it. And we should not extrapolate from the case they spoke about involving, the borrower and the lender's orphans to other situations because of the fact that we don't really agree with, the legal basis of Rav and Shmuel's ruling. We're compelled, though, to adopt it. Rav and Shmuel said it. We'll only adopt it in the specific case in which Rav and Shmuel ruled. The Gemara explains for the Kigon Mai, what would be an example of a different situation where based on Rav Nachman's direction, we would not apply Rav and Shmuel's ruling. Mar says, the Amar of Papa, for example, that which Rav Papa said, a pogem es shtaro, let's say a lender incurred an oath obligation for a whole different reason. For instance, it's a case where he himself acknowledges that part of the debt was already paid. So as the Mishnah taught us, he would have to swear that the remaining balance is owed before he could collect that. And let's say Umeis, he died before he actually took this oath. So here, we would not say like Rav and Shmuel that, it's too late, the estate incurred one kind of oath, and the orphans can't take that same oath, so they can't collect. No, we would not say that. Rather, we would say, Yarshin Ishbayin Shvus Yarshin Venotlin. No problem at all. The lender's orphans would swear that to the best of their knowledge, the debt wasn't collected, and then they could collect. This already is a different context than the context of Rav and Shmuel issued the ruling, where you're talking about an oath that was incurred to swear to collect from orphans. So fine, if you're collecting from the orphans, then we'll adopt Rav and Shmuel's ruling, but not in this other situation, for example. The Gemara relates, There was once a case of a loan where the borrower died, but he left a guarantor in his place. There was a guarantor on the loan, and afterwards, the lender died. The lender's orphans later wanted to collect this debt from the guarantor. Question, of course, is, what about Rav and Shmuel's technicality that the oath that was incurred on the estate already, that, to swear that 100% the debt wasn't collected, the orphans can't take that oath, so perhaps they're unable to collect. The Gemara says, Savar of Papa Lememer, Papa thought to say, at Honami de lo losif alahu, that this would be a case where we would apply Rav Nachman's direction to not add more to the ruling of Rav and Shmuel, being that, we're not talking about a situation here where the lender's orphans are collecting from the borrower's orphans. Rather, the lender's orphans seek to collect from this guarantor. So Papa argued that's already a different case, and therefore we would no longer apply Rav and Shmuel's ruling, and so we would allow the lender's orphans to collect. However, the Gemara rejects this. Amr le'er of Huna b'reder of Yeshua le'er Papa, he pointed out that Otu Arva Lav Basar Yasmi Azil, right after the lender's orphans collect from the guarantor, will the guarantor not, of course, then immediately go to the borrower's orphans to be compensated? Obviously, that's exactly what he's going to do. And therefore, when the lender's orphans collect from the guarantor here, in effect, it's a collection from the borrower's orphans. And so there's no substantive difference in this case. This is considered, you know, within the scope of Rav and Shmuel's original ruling, and therefore we must abide by their ruling still, and therefore the lender's orphans cannot collect here. Gemara relates another case of Ahu Deshache V'Shavak Acha. Again, we have a case where the borrower died, and then the lender died. Here, the lender left only a brother, not orphan sons. He left a brother as his heir. And so the lender's brother produced the loan document seeking to collect from the borrower's orphans. But of course, the question was, in terms of the oath, you know, he's unable to swear, like his deceased brother, that, you know, 100% the debt wasn't collected. So is this a problem? Sava Rami Bar Chama Lameimar. Rami Bar Chama thought to say, Hanami Losef Alahu. He thought that this also would be a situation where we should apply what Rav Nachman said, that since it's not, you know, the exact, you know, situation that Rav and Shmuel were referring to, therefore we should not, you know, extend their ruling to this case, being that it's not the lender's orphans are collecting, but it's the lender's brother. But the Gemara rejects this too. Amrle Rav, Rav has said to Rami Bar Chama, why should that make a difference? Mali shelo pekodani abba, mali shelo pekodani achi. What difference does it make whether the oath will be, you know, I swear that to the best of my knowledge, my father didn't pay the debt, or in this case it would be my brother didn't pay the debt. Why should that make a difference? Either way, you're talking about doing a different oath than the original oath to collect from these borrower's orphans. So the Gemara says, you know, certainly this is not considered as different situation, and so we continue to apply Rav and Shmuel's ruling here that in this case the lender's brother simply cannot collect because he can't take that same exact oath that his brother had incurred. The Gemara now discusses the final halacha on this issue. Amar Rav Chama. Rav Chama said, Hashta de lo itmar hilchasa lo kerav Ushmuel velo kerabi Elazar. Since there's no definitive ruling, whether we say like Rav and Shmuel or like Rabbi Elazar, Rav and Shmuel would say that these lender's orphans cannot collect. Rabbi Elazar had said they could collect, it's fine, even though it's not exactly the same oath. But if they swear, the best of our knowledge, the debt wasn't collected, that's fine. There's nowhere clear, definitive ruling either way, therefore, Hai Dayana, the Oved Kerav Shmuel Avad, the Oved Kerav Elazar Avad. Either way that a judge ruled in this issue would be acceptable. The halacha, you know, does appear to be inclined toward Rav and Shmuel, as is clear from above, but it seems it was not a definitive enough ruling to say that, you know, if a judge ruled like Rabbi Elazar, that would be an invalid judgment. And the Gemara applies this further by saying, Amar Rav Papa, or Papa said, that, you know, based on the above, Haishtara de Yasmi, if we had, you know, this exact kind of case, where the borrower died first and then the lender died, and the lender's orphans now produced the loan document seeking to collect from the borrower's orphans. In practice, lo mikra karinan lei, we should not tear up this loan document at the same time. Velo igvuye magvinan bay. You can't rush to judgment and, you know, go ahead and immediately collect with it either. That is, igvuye lo magvinan bay, you can't just automatically assume that the orphans here could collect with it. Dilma srilin karavu shmuel. Because maybe, you know, when you actually present it to the court, the judge will rule like Rav and Shmuel, and therefore would deny their right to collect. At the same time, we should not, you know, therefore throw the shtar out. Mikolo karina lay. Why? For the haidayna de avik Rabbi Elazar of it, based on what we said above, if a judge ruled like Rabbi Elazar, allowing them to collect here, just take the shvus yorshin and collect, and that would be valid. So therefore, don't tear up this document. Maybe they'll end up bringing it to a court, which will rule like Rabbi Elazar, and then they'll be able to collect. Gemara relates, Ahu dayana de avik Rabbi Elazar, there was once a judge who ruled like Rabbi Elazar. He allowed the lender's orphans to collect. Havitzur v'mir abonan b'masei, that there was a Torah scholar in that community, Amr Lei, and he protested to this ruling. He said, I sina igarta mimarova de les hilchasak Rabbi Elazar. This was not a good ruling. I'm going to bring you a letter from Eretz Yisrael stating that the halacha is not like Rabbi Elazar. Amr Lei, the judge, was unfazed. He said back, l'chi taisi, no problem. When you bring such a letter, then I'll reconsider my ruling. Also the Kameh of Chama, so the Tzurim Rabbanan came to Rav Chama and presented the issue. Amalei Rav Chama said to him, Hai Dayana, the other Kirby Elazar Avad. There's no problem with that judge's ruling. But the conclusion is that if a judge did rule like a Belazar, that's fine, that ruling would be valid. That's acceptable, that's fine. The Mishnah then seemed to describe a category of rabbinic oaths where the person has to swear even though nobody claimed anything from him. So the Gemara wonders, Atib b'shuftani askinan, we're dealing with a bunch of fools. That is, you know, what does that mean, that a person has to swear when nothing at all was claimed from him? So the Gemara explains, Hachi Kamer, this is what the Mishnah is really saying. V'elu nishbayin shelo b'tainas bari. The following have to swear, even though no certain claim was made against them. Ela b'tainas shama. Rather, a mere maybe claim was lodged against them. The plaintiff in these cases said, maybe you owe me money. Maybe you unlawfully took money from me. The Mishnah presents a list where the Rabbanan, you know, although normally, of course, it's not the halacha, but in these cases in particular, they accepted these maybe claims because indeed there is an inherent, you know, suspicion here that maybe the defendant, you know, did rash. And so he will have to swear in answer to that Shema claim. The Mishnah then lists, you know, several situations where a person is in some position, he's helping, you know, managing the affairs for the estate. If a different member of the household says, hey, swear that you didn't take anything for yourself illegally, then the person will have to swear. Now, one of the cases mentioned in the Mishnah was Ben Bias. It is one of the heirs of the estate. We could have him swear that he didn't take anything for himself. Now, Tana the Braisa clarifies, Ben Bias She'amru, it's Ben Bias that they refer to, Lo She'nichnas V'yotze V'raglov, not merely Ben Bias who comes in and out of the estate. It's not, you know, merely his presence that puts him in this position where it becomes legitimate to, you know, suspect him to a certain degree and make him swear. That, you know, would not be the halacha there. Ela Machnas Lo Po'alin U'motzi Lo Po'alin. Machnas lo peiros and motzi lo peiros. Rather, it's specifically referring to Ben Bias, who has real responsibilities in terms of managing the estate. He's hiring and firing workers, he is making purchases for the estate, and all of the cases in the Mishnah have this common denominator, that you're dealing with a person who has been given responsibilities in managing the estate. And so the Gemara explains, Umayishno hani, what is different about all of these that makes them subject to take an oath, even when it was just a Shema claim brought against them? The reason is, Mishum demoru ba'atera. All of these people, there's a potential for them to rationalize that I'm allowed to take something for myself here. I'm doing all of this hard work. I'm volunteering here. You know, I earned it. I'm going to take some for myself. That is why in these cases, you know, when a different member of the household, let's say, says they swear that you've been honest here, even if the plaintiff is not saying that he knows one way or the other whether something dishonest occurred, he still has to swear to alleviate our concern that maybe he rationalized and took some money for himself. The Gemara qualifies this ruling. Amar Rav Yosef bar Minyumi, Amar Rav Nachman, says this ruling of the Mishnah is Vehu Sheyesh Taina Beinayush De Kesef. The Mishnah's ruling here only applies when we have a certain minimum of money on the line. It is the claim has to be worth at least 2 silver ma coins. If it's less than that, then it would not obligate the defendant to swear. The Gemara points out, Kiman, apparently who is Rav Nachman assuming like, in terms of the discussion we had in Lamed Ches, Amid Beis, between Rav and Shmuel, regarding the understanding of the biblical oath, where a person who admits to part of a claim, the Torah says, the defendant has to swear, but the party is denying. And the Mishnah said, there's a minimum for the oath to apply of 2 silver ma coins. The Gemara had a discussion about, you know, what does that mean exactly? To what is the minimum applied? To the plaintiff's claim? Or does it mean the defendant's denial must encompass at least 2 silver ma? So Gemara points out that Rav Nachman's language here regarding our rabbinic oath, that the taina, which seems to refer to the plaintiff's claim, must be a minimum of 2 ma. Come on, who is that like? Shmuel. Rav Nachman apparently is siding with Shmuel, who understands that the minimum of 2 silver ma applies to the plaintiff's claim. The Gemara points out that seems problematic for V'yotoni Rabbi Chiya L'siyuei L'rav. But we concluded in that discussion in Lamed Ches, we brought up Braisa in support of Rav's opinion. And we concluded that the halacha is like Rav. So what do we make of this? That Rav Nachman, you know, goes against Rav like Shmuel? The Gemara answers, Eima Kfiras Taina K'Rav. We have to adjust the reading a bit here of Rav Nachman's ruling. Rav Nachman is really saying that the rabbinic oath would not apply unless the defendant was denying at least 2 silver ma, and that would be in accordance with Rav. It is that, you know, in the rabbinic oath here, the Rabbanan modeled it after the Torah, that we Rav understands that the Torah's oath would only apply if the denial was about at least 2 ma. So too, the rabbinic oath would only apply if the denial involved at least 2 ma. The Mishnah then explained about these rabbinic oaths that there is like a window of opportunity to demand the oath. Like if at the time that, let's say, the partners are dissolving their partnership, a partner demands that the other partner swear that he was not dishonest here, then he can make him swear. But if afterwards, after they already dissolved the partnership, later he wants to go make him swear, at that point it would be too late. However, the Mishnah said, still a way to have him swear through the halacha of Gilgal Shvu, which says that if he has some other dispute with this person, and in that dispute he legitimately imposed an obligation on him to swear, well then, you know, once he has to swear to this person, you know, for the issue at hand, the plaintiff would also make the defendant swear about some previous issue, like for example, his suspicion that, you know, with their partnership, that he was stealing from him. Through a Gilgal Shvu, he can have him swear. The Gemara asks a question about this concept. May a person do this, you know, roll over, impose an additional oath about something else, which on its own, it wouldn't be enough to make him swear. Could one do that based on a rabbinic oath? Like, let's say you have one of the cases of the Mishnah that imposes a rabbinic oath. Could he say, okay, once I'm having you swear about this rabbinic oath, I'm going to have you swear about something else, when on that issue I technically wasn't able to have you swear, but now I can force you to swear on that issue? Or maybe the idea of Gilgal Shvuah, which is learned from the Parsha of Sota, only applies when Shvuah A is a biblical oath. The Gemara tries to prove the answer from a Braisa. Toshma, I come here, a Braisa that says, if Lava Heimenu Erev Shvias, say somebody borrowed money before the Shemitah year, Lamatsoi Shvias Nasa Loshutif O'aris, after the conclusion of the Shemitah year, and of course we know the Shemitah year cancels all debts, after Shemitah, these two people entered a partnership, and it came to a situation where he exercised his right to have the other partner take the rabbinic oath that he wasn't dishonest, says the Braisa, Ein Megagalin. In this case, the plaintiff may not take that rabbinic oath that he is, you know, forcing this person to swear, and use that to have him also swear about the money that he had borrowed before Shemitah. Like, for example, the defendant here says, no, I never borrowed that money. So the lender wants to use the rabbinic oath that he's now forcing this other person to swear as the Gilgal Shvuah. And now you have to also swear about that loan that you took from me that you deny from before Shvias, that I say I lent you. Says the Braisa, that does not work. You can't force him to swear about that loan that happened before Shemitah. So the Gemara infers, Taima de lava himenu erev Shvias. Evidently, the only reason why you can't be Megalgel, again, you know, take Shvuah A about the partnership and force him to swear Shvuah B about the loan, is because that loan occurred before Shemitah. And so the Asya Shvias of Kase, Shemitah year, canceled that debt. So the debt is long gone. You can't have him swear about that. Ha'ashar Shnei Shvuah Megalgelin. The Brice implies that if, however, the loan was not before Shemitah, Shemitah didn't cancel it, then he could use this rabbinic oath that arose from their partnership to be Megalgel, to then force him to also swear about the loan. So this would answer our question that evidently the principle of Gilgal Shvuah applies even if the first Shvuah is a rabbinic oath. The Gemara attempts to deflect the proof by saying, Lo tema ha shar shnei shvuah Megalgelin. Don't make the inference from the Braisa that way. We could say that's not, you know, what the Braisa wanted us to infer. Ela ema. Rather, you say it like this. This is the point that we should infer. That the halacha, the Braisa said, that, you know, we don't say Gilgal Shvuah is only when things happen in the order described, where the loan happened before Shemitah and the partnership happened after Shemitah, as opposed to if Nasa lo shutev o'ares erev Shvias. The partnership happened before Shemitah, and the loan occurred after Shemitah, and the defendant incurred an oath obligation based on that loan. Let's say he denied part of the loan. So he was obligated to swear, but the party was denying? Or we're supposed to infer from the Braisa is that, oh, in this case, Megagalin, we would indeed, you know, say that, okay, based on Shvuah A for the loan, the plaintiff could also force the defendant to swear on Shvuah B, namely, he'll have to swear that he wasn't dishonest regarding that partnership.
For Shemitah, while it cancels loans, does not cancel partnerships or any, you know, accompanying oaths having to do with partnerships. So in this case, Gilgul Shavuah would apply. According to this reading, the Braisa would not be commenting on the issue of, you know, can you use a rabbinic oath to force an additional oath. The Gemara rejects this proposed reading. The Gemara points out, ha, v'hejik tani la. You can't say that that's what the Braisa wants us to infer from the first case, because this point is stated explicitly in the second case of the Braisa. The Braisa goes on to say, and if, however, the Braisa itself spells out that if the partnership happened before Shemitah and the loan after Shemitah, then we would be Megagalin. Then, as explained above, he could force him to swear about the partnership based on the first oath regarding the loan. So, obviously, the first case of the Braisa wasn't coming to discuss this case. Rather, it must be as we originally inferred, that there's a clear inference here that the only reason there's no Gilgul Shavuah in the first case of the Braisa is because of the Shemitah year, which canceled that loan. Without that factor, Gilgul Shavuah would apply, even though we're dealing with where Shavuah A is rabbinic oath. So the Gemara says, Shmamina, Megagalin b'derabbanan, Shmamina. Indeed, it's clear from this Braisa, the answer to our question is that you could use even a rabbinic oath to do Gilgul Shavuah. The Gemara qualifies, though. Amar Rav Huna. Rav Huna said, although we're concluding here that a rabbinic oath can create or generate this halacha of Gilgul Shavuah, continuing the Mem Tes of an Aleph, la kol megagalin. In general, this is true. Chutz misachir, she'ain megagalin. There's an exception, though, that if we're dealing with this specific rabbinic oath incurred in the case of a worker who claims he wasn't paid, the employer says, I did pay you. The Mishnah said the worker swears he wasn't paid and collects. Says Rav Huna, this specific rabbinic oath would not have the power to force the defendant to swear about additional things. And the reason is because the Gemara Mem Hei above concluded that really this oath should not be necessary, because our presumption is that this worker was not paid. The employer is very busy with his different workers, so we assume he misremembers, and we believe the worker. Why then does the worker swear? The Gemara said, "Kidei lahafiz daito shavala bayis." It is merely to appease the employer, to set his mind at ease. You know, this individual employer might feel, no, I do remember. So to appease him, we have the worker swear. But being that it's not an oath that stems from any kind of, you know, suspicion that the worker is lying, that, you know, he's collecting a second time, well, therefore, this kind of oath will not have the power to, you know, force the defendant to swear about additional things. Now, Rav Chisda seems to echo this teaching. Rav Chisda Amar, Rav Chisda also said that la kol ein mikilin is a general rule. Even if you're talking about a rabbinic oath, we're not going to be lenient on the defendant in terms of swearing about other things. No, we will have him swear about other things. Chutz misacher the mikilin. The exception of the rabbinic oath, by the case of the worker, where we are lenient, we won't have the defendant swear about additional things. Because again, you know, this oath is unique. It's not really based on any suspicion. Rather, it's just to appease the defendant. The Gemara explains, my binayu. So what's the difference between Rav Huna and Rav Chisda? Are they just saying the exact same thing? The Gemara explains, ikke binayu liftoach lo. There is actually a difference between Rav Huna and Rav Chisda in terms of whether we, the court, will open this up, whether we will suggest to the plaintiff that he have the defendant swear about other things, if applicable. Rav Huna's language of megagalin implies that we do that. Megagalin, we will suggest this even if the plaintiff himself didn't. As opposed to the way Rav Chisda is describing it, the way the system works is that, you know, if the plaintiff requests that the defendant swear about other things, then normally we'll grant that request even by rabbinic oaths, but by the rabbinic oath, by the sachir, we don't grant that request. And the Mishnah taught us that the Shemitah year not only cancels loans, but even an oath obligation associated with the loan. Like if somebody omitted to part of a loan, so he had a biblical obligation to swear, but with the passing of the Shemitah year, that obligation to swear goes away. The Gemara asks, Minani Mili, from where do we know this? The Gemara answers, Amrav Gidel Amrav, the Amar Kra. For the Pasuk says, Vezed Dvar HaShemitah. This is the Dvar HaShemitah, the matter of the Shemitah, discussing the Shemitah law there. From this language of Devar, we derive Yafilu Dibor Mishametes, that the Shemitah year has the power to cancel even an obligation having to do with speech, and that is an oath. Tara is teaching us that the Shemitah year even cancels an oath that was incurred based on alone. This then concludes the seventh parak of Shavuos Hadron Alach Kol HaNishbayim.
You've been listening to RealClearDaf.com. Visit us online for resources or to dedicate a shiur. To speak with Rabbi Wise, call 855-ASK-RCD1. That's 855-275-7231.